Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Saul Estrin, Professor of Management, and I'm chairing this fifth session of Entrepreneurship Matters. Welcome to you all. Before I introduce our speaker for this evening, Duncan Clark, I'm just going to make a few preliminary announcements. First of all, to say that we still have, even after this, no doubt outstanding talk, we will have even more highlights to come. In 2 weeks, we have Walker Lady, and then on the 17th of March, Lisa Bridget. And I hope we see you all there as well. Secondly, as my colleague Alvin Marley introduced at the last one of these lectures, one of the things we're doing is on our website, we're running a poll which relates to entrepreneurship, which gives us a chance, I think, to get an idea about what young people and some not quite so young people based around the LSE think about current issues in entrepreneurship. We previously talked about social entrepreneurship, and we were trying to get views on what people thought were the real, the true objectives of social entrepreneurial firms. Now, the second of these polls, and the results of that, I'm not going to give it all away, you can look on the website and find out. The second of these relates to something I'm currently working on, which is crowdfunding. Equity crowdfunding, as some of you will know, is growing at the rate where the amount of money raised is well over doubling every year. And the UK is in a slightly unusual position, I think, of being just at the moment probably the world leader in equity crowdfunding as early stage finance. Essentially because of US regulatory policy, it has to be said, so I suppose that will not start long. So, the question we've got to ask is this: is this crowdfunding thing just a fad? Is it just, you know, another version of social network? Or is it actually, is this the financial technological innovation which is going to push venture capitalists and private equity out of business? Or indeed, something in between those two extremes. So it's going to be up to you to make some sort of decision on that. We'll see what we're doing here, as crowdfunding does, is we're trying to rely on the wisdom of the crowd to determine what we feel is likely to be the future. So if you're the crowd, I'm not going to do all the things well, you don't. And that's how you do it. Well, Entrepreneurship Matters, this is the team, that's me. Al is over there, Carol and Sarah and Woodgill are at the front. And at the end of this talk, we will have a networking event, and I hope you'll get a chance, if you haven't met us already, to get to know us all somewhat better. Well, I think that's the end of my that's the end of my remarks, except to introduce our speaker. Now, it's mildly embarrassing to think about, for both of us, actually. Yes. For both of us, but actually, Duncan here, I taught in a course some of you will know called Economics B, which, you know, a hugely high proportion of the students at LSE at some point took, and which I taught for my sins for 5 years in this place, though a long time ago. Not that long, Duncan. And Duncan was a student. And it just shows that obviously it was a better piece of education than I thought it was, because he's now an incredibly successful guy that has an OBE. Now, Duncan is one of the people who very, very early on went to China. He, much to my admiration, learnt Chinese. I visited China for an extended period twice. Sat in on classes, talked to people, and I'm not entirely sure that I can actually pay in a taxi, let alone order in a restaurant in Chinese, despite that. And I have a colleague who's been there 4 years, and he can't order in a restaurant properly. But Duncan has been there a long time. He's learnt Chinese, not the easiest language in the world. Perhaps more importantly, he's had really quite a big effect on what's gone on in China,
in terms of entrepreneurship and internet entrepreneurship, and he's now going to tell us about it. Duncan, over to you.
Thanks. Can you hear me? Is the mic working? Yep. Okay, great.
Over, Duncan.
Oh, yes, thanks. Well, so you'll be happy to learn that because of the internet, and particularly mobile phones, you don't need to know how to order a taxi or pay for a taxi. You can do it all through your phone. In fact, over the weekend, the two biggest competitors in that market, the ride booking market, like Uber, announced a merger. One of them is backed by Alibaba, and one is backed by Tencent. So this is the problem with expats moving to China now. Don't need to learn any Chinese. So. But this is not by, well, it is a way of saying who we are, my company, BDA, but because our growth over the last 20 years reflects really the growth of the private sector in China. So BDA is a company I set up. I'm the D, Duncan. B is Dr. Zhang Bohai. We were BD associates. We were formed for 1 year after LSE. I joined Morgan Stanley, moved to Hong Kong, and set up the company in 1994. It was for 1 year that I moved to China. So I didn't actually learn Chinese for the first several years because I didn't think I was going to stay. But China had other plans for me, and I think many people who end up going there and staying is because of the tremendous growth. And I went there as a telecoms guy. And in China, when I moved there, I had 200,000 mobile phones. They were much bigger. Actually, funnily, mobile phones are getting big again. For a while, they were getting smaller and smaller. Now they're getting big again. So actually, yes, the 6 Plus is bigger than the phone that I first had in 1994. But that phone cost, well, also about $2,000. but pagers, mobile phones, were just beginning, really, in China. And so this telecom and technology, that was why I went. That's what I was doing at Morgan Stanley. But as the internet came along, and actually this year will mark 20 years of commercial internet in China, it opened up the private sector to whole new areas, including media, and we're going to talk a lot about today, also the consumer sector, commerce, e-commerce. Anyway, so our firm today, we're 100 people, I think 3 or 4 of them are actually LSE grads now. I'm the only foreigner, so I have to keep my Chinese up. But their English, frankly, is so good now that my Chinese is getting worse, because most of them have probably studied overseas, at least at their master's level. So we helped, actually, the first LSE recruiting in China we hosted. And now we share that with other minor universities like Oxford and Cambridge and Imperial. So there's a great rise of private sector. Some of the kids, frankly, the people who are joining us, 21, 22-year-olds, I should say, born after 1990, their parents, some of them are entrepreneurs, as well as traditionally, you know, more government background. So China is changing, and this growth of the private sector is really what we're here to talk about today. And entrepreneurship. So we do due diligence for companies. We're right opposite the China Central Television Building, if you know Beijing, The Rem Koolhaas structure. I actually got to go in the other day. It's been around since 2008, but this is the efficiency of the state sector. Nobody moved in until a few months ago. And everybody hates it there, actually. It looks great, but it's very cold. And anyway, but you can now actually get into that building. You can only see a bit of it there. So this is what I was describing earlier. The telecoms wave, again, China going from a backwater 200,000 mobile phones to now the largest, you know, everything technology market. Internet, we're going to talk a little bit about the first Chinese internet entrepreneurs. And we have somebody in the room, actually, who met very early on. Heather used to run Yahoo International and met Jack Ma. And we met in China, actually, in 1998, I think. Yes. In fact, Jack Ma, when he first met Jerry Yang, was with Heather. So not to embarrass you, you're already wearing red, so you're plenty. But those fateful 99, 2000, when Jack Ma and William Ding and other individuals really sparked this amazing internet revolution. And then really from sort of the mid-2000s, we saw this proliferation of private investment and entrepreneurship into those areas I showed you earlier, like the consumer sector and media and those other things. I speak fast. I speak too fast. Do tell me. But I'm under time pressure here, so okay. So, Deng Xiaoping, it's been 37 years since the early 1978 revolution and so on of reform and opening. But one could argue that actually the internet and the private sector has had the greatest impact on creating this sort of landscape. I mean, a lot of these buildings we see, like the CCTV building, are actually representatives of state-owned enterprises. And today, still, you know, most of the Fortune 500 companies from China are actually state funded. But if you're looking at the growth, and if you're those of you who want to work in banking, you know, last year, I think Goldman Sachs in China did more advisory work on IPOs and things for private sector companies than they did for state-owned enterprises. So there's a big change happening. That we've had these trophy Chinese companies. We were talking earlier about China Mobile and all these big companies. But now, I mean, Alibaba's IPO, as you know, last September, was the largest IPO in history, $25 billion. And market capitalization varying a little bit recently. But these are here to stay, these private sector companies. So not many people know, well, people in China know Yiwu, and a lot of people in the Middle East and other places know Yiwu because it started as a stinky ditch when a few hundred merchants were allowed to start their selling their wares. This is in Zhejiang province, not too far from Hangzhou. I'm actually writing a book about Alibaba, which will come out later this year, so I'm really digging into Zhejiang right now. It tends to be somewhat unpronounceable for Westerners because we know Guangdong and so on, and we know the export business of Guangdong, but actually Zhejiang and this place Yiwu was where really one of the first early commodities markets in China was allowed to thrive. There was a tradition of private entrepreneurship in this area going back way before the 16th century, but today, you know, this is a massive complex of merchants who are basically selling to the world, and there's a large, there are mosques here, there's an international airport. This is a place which really is embodies the rise of the private sector. And it all started with people selling, you know, surplus agricultural products, and now is a major cog in small commodities. So clothing, but also tchotchkes, you know, everything really. Yiwu is really where it all started. And so private sector has actually led growth in China. It completely accounts for all job creation in China today, because obviously the state sector is actually shrinking in output, in productivity of capital, in exports, and now even in foreign direct investment. We'll start to see here in London privately held Chinese companies investing in property and actually buying companies, and Wanda, as you know. We can argue about how private some of these companies are, how much have government support, but increasingly you are seeing privately led companies buying assets overseas as well as exporting and all the other fun stuff that's been driving GDP growth. As you know, so the Chinese economy grew 25 times between 1978 and 2013, and now China's GDP is up in the mid sort of teens, and the private sector has been a big part of that. Now, going back to Chinese language, so famously George Bush said that, he didn't actually say, but it's fun to say that he did, that the French don't have a word for entrepreneur, so Google doesn't return entrepreneur. It does, actually. I changed it. If you put English entrepreneur, the French don't know what to say. So in Chinese, what I was talking about earlier with the Ge Tihu, which is like the first wave of entrepreneurs were basically Beverly Hillbillies. They were a little bit, you know, they wear the Louis, not even Vuitton, what's the other one, but basically really nouveau riche, you know, take the whole village out to a banquet, show off. That was kind of the 80s kind of generation of entrepreneurs. And then really from the mid-90s, we started to have this concept of government officials and others, better educated people, wanting to become entrepreneurs. So Siying Qiejia, these are people who are actually more, you know, frankly respectable, and entrepreneurs were not seen as so brash. And what's interesting about Jack Ma is that he was actually a bit of both, because when Jack Ma started his first venture, which was a translation company, and he went on to found Alibaba 5 years later, the translation company was, you know, he kept his job as a professor, so he would actually, you know, for the first year, he actually would be in the book. There's a lot been written which isn't correct about Jack. But basically, he kept his day job and then had a translation company, but it didn't do very well, so he had to actually sell stuff on the street. So he was actually kind of he actually went to Yiwu to buy stuff that he could sell, you know, flowers and things on the streets just to cover. And it was, you know, it was still a bit dodgy, frankly, to be an entrepreneur then. You weren't actually protected. There was no limited liability for a long time. So entrepreneurship, you know, it wasn't encouraged. It was actively discriminated against initially. But what we'll see is how now, at the very least, neutral stance to entrepreneurs in China, and actually, I think, a very supportive environment. Meanwhile, at Stanford University, this was a sketch done in 1991, and I spent a few years at Stanford recently, where we researched the origins of the internet in China, and Slack, which you may know is a linear accelerator next to Stanford, was actually the first permanent internet connection to the Institute of High Energy Physics in Beijing. And actually, 21 years ago now, China connected to the internet. The first commercial internet access, as I mentioned earlier, was actually 20 years ago this year. And I was signed on, I think, in the summer of 1995. My partner, the B, the guy who had studied in Texas, he wanted to play games. So I didn't know what the internet was myself. And the idea was to connect. Initially, it was a 9.6K connection. None of you youngsters will know what that means, but it's incredibly frustratingly slow. And again, it was an academic project, as obviously the US started defense, but very quickly it was an academic project. And so the combination of what I was just describing, the whole EWU and this entrepreneurship culture that was beginning to happen in the mid-90s to really get some headway, the internet came along. And then basically today, you know, China is twice the US population is online in China. So the entire US population times two is online today in China. And that's still only under 48% of the Chinese population, so still a long way to go. The growth actually did slow last year, so it only grew 30 million, you know, down from 54 million the previous year. And now 80% of Chinese use mobile phones or tablets to get online. I mean, they may still also, like you, have a laptop or a PC, but mobile internet is really the way to go. So, as I mentioned earlier, there were three companies that really formed in the late 90s, and they were the first companies to go public on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ: Sina, NetEase, and Soho. And it's quite amazing that these companies were allowed to go public because what they are, they're basically private entrepreneur-led companies. In the case of Sina, they're particularly interested in the news service in China, and still for a lot of Chinese, Sina, or now it's derivative Weibo, which is the sort of mobile messaging service, is the primary source of news for many people, which is a surprising thing if you think of, you know, one-party state. NetEase became very big in games and is still today, and Sohu was sort of has morphed into a few other things, also games. But these companies, you know, really, it was this IPO, and I was working with two of these companies, Sina and NetEase, but they almost didn't go public. And had they not gone public in 2000, don't forget the dot-com crash was happening at this time, we wouldn't really have had this, you know, stamp of approval or at least tolerance from the Chinese government to private-led media and to internet companies. And they went public with this very complicated, I don't expect you to understand this because nobody really does, but it's the variable interest entity. This was derived for the Sina IPO, and you'll still hear people talking about this. If you were to take the Alibaba prospectus from last year, at least 20 pages of risk factors will accommodate, you know, all of these sort of arrows and issues. Basically, China is squaring the circle. They're saying local entrepreneurs can run these companies, foreigners can back them, but they don't really own the business. So you own the rights to revenue streams if certain conditions are met. And what this is basically is the Communist Party sort of realizing that the internet is essential for China to become a developed competitive economy, but they didn't get the memo about the internet sort of leading to complete freedom and opening. So this is their way of actually having the ability to lean on people. So the legal person who holds the shares for Sina or even Alibaba, I mean, is Jack Ma, for example. I mean, they know who to call. They didn't want to call out, frankly, Yahoo. And you know, Yahoo and Facebook and Google famously have all had challenges. Yahoo did the best because they bet on Alibaba. And that investment returned more than any other. Another South African company that people don't know much about called Naspers made a $40 million investment in Tencent, which is now worth about $50 billion. So, you know, a lot of the bigger companies like Google and Facebook and others have had a hard time saying we can't really allow Chinese to run our business. And so, but VIE is what you have to do. Anyway, so if you want to dig into this, this is still, you know, this has created more jobs for lawyers in China than perhaps even the WTO, actually, which is saying something. So it's sort of dodgy, but it's durable, the VIE structure. And it was interesting, even after the IPO, this is a picture back from 2004. So, you know, this is Charles Zhang from Sohu. This is Ding Lei, William Ding from NetEase. So these were the early internet portals. You know, already these guys were worth, you know, billions of dollars. And yet, you know, they were asked to carry a wreath to honor Chinese Communist Party soldiers. There is an interesting life that these guys lead. And today we can talk about that with Jack Ma and others. They have to serve the market. They have to do quarterly, you know, shareholder reports. They have to get on the conference calls. They have to go to New York. On the other hand, they may get called to some government meeting back in China. So they live a very interesting life. And there is basically a contract You know, if you want to get rich, fine. And we're going to talk about why the Chinese government wants that. They contribute to the economy in many ways. But they also have to know who's boss. And the party still wants to remind them from time to time of that side of the equation. So then in 2003, 4, 5, we saw the rise of other companies, C-Trip. Anybody booking tickets in China will probably use this, or a more recent competitor called Qunar, which is invested by Baidu. Tencent, I mean, we're all on WeChat. Anybody in the room here who's from China or has been to China is on WeChat, which has hundreds of millions. It's so much bigger than WhatsApp, so much more effective, frankly. But it started, QQ was an instant messaging service. Baidu, as you know, famously, with respect to Google, effectively it is the Google of China. And why it became the Google of China, there's a whole story around. But, you know, Shanda and games, this was the second wave. This is when money started saying, well, it's not that risky, frankly. We've seen huge returns from these first internet portals. And then, you know, I mean, last year, obviously, I mean, Alibaba listed its first B2B business in 2007, but last year it listed the group, including Taobao, which we're going to talk about. You know, everybody buys everything today online. 80%+ of the Chinese e-commerce market is controlled by Alibaba. So this was the largest ever IPO, and it was a huge breathlessness, and it was an amazing experience. I was actually at the launch of the IPO in New York, and at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And interestingly, I think about 6 weeks after that, the Chinese bought the Waldorf Astoria Hotel for $2 billion. Not Alibaba, although Jack could easily have done that. But so it's just the sense that it was just, you know, we're at the cusp of something. So if you add all this stuff up, and I mean, basically the market capitalization of all these internet companies today is $600+ billion, and the revenues are in the $70 billion. So, you know, I mean, one can argue, as people have, about profitability and so on, but now a lot of these internet companies are very profitable, particularly Tencent and Alibaba. So this isn't the internet of 99, 2000, you know, let's hope it works. I think some of these companies are extremely profitable. Now, what they're paying to buy each other or buy the next companies, one can argue there's a bit of a bubble right now. So I mentioned these two taxi booking apps. The combined value of these companies is, you know, a few billion dollars. So is this worth it? I mean, the same with Uber and other valuations. We're wondering how much these companies are worth. But there is a lot of money being made in this sector. I'll share this later. But at the same time, here we have Lu Wei, who's the director of China's State Information Office, who has effectively inherited, actually, quite a lot of the blocks that were put in YouTube, Google, Twitter, Facebook. Now, Google had been blocked once in 2002 when I was living there. I still live in Beijing. But there was an outrage then that we couldn't get onto Google, particularly amongst Chinese academics. And after about a month, that block was removed. Interestingly, the block that happened last year, I think around the time of what was going on, Occupy, I think, in Hong Kong, there was, you know, suddenly a big increase in difficulties on getting online on Google, Gmail, you know, cloud-based services, and now effectively it's blocked. And what's more challenging for people based in China is the VPNs that everybody uses to jump over the wall increasingly are themselves under attack. So there's a big debate here. You know, is this the new policy under Xi Jinping that basically we're big enough now, that China's a walled garden is big enough that we really can block off access to the international companies. I'm not going to go too much into this topic today, but it's an interesting backdrop to any discussion with a Chinese internet entrepreneur, particularly, say, Robin Li at Baidu. You know, how much of your success has come from the fact that your competitors were kicked out? Or in the case of Google, you can say they kicked themselves out because they... but anyway, it's the first thing, if you go to Baidu, the first thing they will show you on the tour is, this is our certificate for search. We registered this a month before Google even had a patent, and so methinks they protest too much. There is a sense of, you know, that they're wronged, actually, in the international, you know, press, that they're always... On the other hand, there are some amazing innovations happening in China today. I would argue WeChat, for example, from Tencent, as I mentioned, is better than products in the West. So it's a challenge because everything gets wrapped up. This guy's everywhere now, Lu Wei, and actually... He even went, well, Mark Zuckerberg famously got up and spoke Chinese, sort of, at Tsinghua University. By the way, Jack Ma's English is much better than Mark Zuckerberg's Chinese, but still, kudos for trying. But rather alarmingly, when Lu Wei went He also met Tim Cook at Apple, but he went to visit Zuckerberg. This is him sitting in Mark Zuckerberg's chair, and rather strangely, on the desk, you may have seen the story, the collected works of Xi Jinping had been put there, and Mark Zuckerberg said, "I've instructed all of my colleagues to read this interesting book." A week before that, I had a call from a guy called Richard McGregor, who wrote an excellent book called The Party. If you ever want to understand the Communist Party in China, Richard was the Beijing bureau chief for the FT. He's now in Washington. And he actually, he'd asked me, he'd been invited to dinner with Mark Zuckerberg. And I said, amazing. What would you tell him? I said, I gave him some ideas. I didn't tell him to put Xi Jinping's book of governance of China. So I'm hoping inside this book is actually Richard McGregor's book on the party. And I hope Mark Zuckerberg read that. But it's a sign of how much frustration there is among some of these internet pioneers in Silicon Valley to get into China. It's like Excalibur. It's the sword and the stone. You see dead people around, and yet you still want to have a go. So I'm not sure what this will yield for Zuckerberg. In fact, various elements of the service, including Instagram, have been blocked now as well. So it just seems to be getting worse. But anyway, but back to Chinese companies, because that's much easier. BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent. This is what everybody's talking about today. We're in the BAT area. Reason is, these are all big companies, as we saw earlier. They're in the 70 billion, they're in the 100 plus billions, 200 plus billion. So these companies are large. They increasingly buy companies that are in interesting areas. As I mentioned, the taxi booking, or we can go through many different services. They're seen as sort of the, not the mafia, but they're sort of, they're the new royalty, if you will. And, you know, there had been a debate before. Actually, Tencent was particularly unpopular because startups would emerge with some interesting idea, and Tencent would be like, yeah, we'll have that, and they would just roll it out on, you know, hundreds of millions of customers, and, you know, tough luck. Recently, in the last few years, they've become a lot more acquisitive. So they're actually now, they've actually created a second wave of interest from investors, because you might back a company that gets bought for $5 billion. Not bad, you know, you're not going to be a $100 billion company maybe, but not too bad, and you might have four or five of these things as an investor. So we are in the BAT area, and in A, I mean, Alibaba is the biggest, and in terms of consumer e-commerce, as I mentioned, it's, you know, 80% of China's consumer e-commerce market. So in any normal market, you might have some government intervention to say, you know, maybe we're going to break you up. And what's very interesting, I think, for this topic about is the sky the limit for entrepreneurs? You know, at what point does some air traffic control, say, descend to 22,000 feet? Because they're flying very high. You know, these companies are buying other ventures. It's not a very interesting slide, but, you know, the core of this, Baidu, is in search, as we mentioned. So they are the Google, effectively, of China. They even had a Google Glass, or they didn't call it. Shows you shouldn't always copy everything because it might not work. So the Baidu Glass project is probably on ice right now. Alibaba dominates in e-commerce, and Tencent was very much in the games and messaging service. So those are the three core areas. Of course, with mobile, you know, everything is beginning to merge because everything's about the desktop. And so Alibaba, for example, has its own operating software that it wants to get into. Logistics, not just Alibaba, but their competitor, Jingdong, JD. Everybody's investing now in warehouses and new ways of getting products instantly to customers. Big data, absolutely huge. I mean, Alibaba knows more about the Chinese consumer than the Chinese government, by far, because if you buy anything online, you might very likely to use Alibaba, and you're very likely to use Alipay, which is the currency for paying for it. So they have an insane amount of knowledge about individual areas, families, your intention to buy something, you're thinking about something. cloud computing as well. Baidu has been investing. They've set up in Silicon Valley. They've hired a senior person there from Google. Mobile, as I said. So, you know, there's a lot of battlegrounds between these companies to protect their turf, but also to grab new areas like the taxi booking area. So here, Didi, Dache, and Kuaidi, this is the Tencent logo, this is Alibaba. These companies were bashing heads to the point that they were spending hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidy. There was a period when, as a customer, you could get into a taxi. They would pay you to get into the taxi. They would pay the driver. Alarmingly, they would reward the driver with beer, which I didn't think was a very good idea. But it was very popular with the drivers. there was a mad, insane competition for the customer because they want to be, you know, the Uber of China. Now, interestingly, where's Uber in this? Well, who's missing here is Baidu. So Baidu has partnered with Uber. It was quite late to the game, actually. So we've seen this weird kind of, like, subsidy sometimes for customers. And actually, what, that's a very important point to make, is that as a customer in China offline, you never really had any service. I mean, I remember still to this day, if you go into the more traditional shops in China, you find something, oh, I want to buy this, maybe around, you know, walk around, can I buy this? Mm. You know, lunch break, you know. And then eventually you find what you want to buy. They say, you've got to pay over there, right? So you go over there and pay, and they come back with 17 pieces of paper, and it's a horrible experience. Suddenly online, you're a king. You know, if you buy something online from Taobao or Tmall that doesn't work, you don't like it, you can return it and you know, pay nothing. The merchant will pay for the postage. They will beg you to not give them a negative rating or take points off them. And so some of us who shop on Taobao, my friend here, we sometimes you'll see defective products is a dream because you can actually get you know a year's supply or something. Now, the interesting case from 10 days ago was the government said that a lot of stuff that Alibaba is selling on Taobao is fake. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people who still want to buy fakes. China, cheapskates. I'm half Scottish. I understand this. You know, people like to buy fakes. Surprise! The Louis Vuitton that I bought for $5 is not real. Shock, horror. You know, and to Alibaba's credit, I mean, the government took a survey of like three people, and you know, they found the other competitors were better than Alibaba. The reality is, this is a huge challenge for anybody online in China, and I think there was some settling down of that. But the fact is, the consumer is God online, and they're dirt offline. So this is why the internet is so powerful in China, because for the first time, consumers are feeling like they have choice, and they have rights. So, and so as a result, we see this massive increase of e-commerce, almost $500 million last year, and you know, so bigger than the United States, 12% of total commerce now is online. And we really see no reason for it to slow down because, you know, with a mobile phone, I mean, one example, you know, for example, we're having this event now, it's sunny outside when we came in. If it started to rain, and my friend here had this experience, well, no problem, just get online and order some umbrellas, and they'll be there within an hour. So weather's not an issue. I mean, for the UK, that's got to be attractive. And yet, you know, so consumption as a percentage of the Chinese economy, as we know, is too low. I mean, China had been highly dependent on manufacturing, on export. That's driven, you know, lots of pollution. Excuse my coughing. You know, so China knows it has to get off this model. And what could be better, actually, than this sort of steroid injection, or MSG, if you will, of e-commerce? And this is why Jack Ma, you know, even though there's some controversy sometimes, he's been feted by the Chinese Prime Minister. You know, several times a year, he's been invited to Zhongnanhai to describe what he can do and so on. Because the government, the Communist Party wants to stay in power. So how can they stay in power, continue to drive economic growth? Well, we've seen a slowing macro environment, obviously troubles in exports. We've had pollution and other issues domestically. So consumption really is the golden topic these days. So there are huge kind of winds in the sails, if you will, of some of the e-commerce companies right now. Just some random stats. The top three grocery chains in China together have 7% of the market. In the United States, they have 37%. So it's huge fragmentation offline. To my point earlier that it's not a very good experience buying offline. You know, consumer electronics, for example, the top three that are still remaining, 50% of the market. In China, only 21%. So e-commerce, in a way, it's not sort of replacing things. It's, in some cases, creating experiences for consumers. It never really existed offline. So this is why we're seeing this tearaway growth. Advertising, just looking at the three key models for the Chinese internet in terms of revenue have been, firstly, games, and Tencent benefited very much from that. Then also online advertising, these early portals I talked about. You know, still China's half of the US in terms of its online advertising market. And then we mentioned e-commerce. So those are the three key drivers. Back to e-commerce, Alibaba's it's adding more than one Amazon a year in terms of gross merchandise volume. So you can see there doesn't seem to be much headwind right now in terms of the consumer market. Maybe the regulatory, you know, challenges will be the biggest area. So now we just had Valentine's Day over the weekend here. Forget that. I mean, in China, it's all about Singles Day. There are a lot more single people out there, you rest assured, than there are people happily in relationships. So Alibaba, it wasn't their invention, actually. I think it came from Nanjing University or something. But they adopted this idea of 1-1. Why is it the 11th of November? Because two ones together, you know, it's lots of single people. And so last November 11th, $9 billion was sold in one day. Including you know, 200 million people buying on their mobile phone. Over 1.25 million people were employed delivering packages. This gets to about 60, 70, well, on that day, probably 80% of the Chinese Postal Service, but regularly Alibaba is over 60% of the Chinese Postal Service. He's actually bought part of the Singapore Postal Service. Maybe the Royal Mail soon will be Alibaba as well, but a million people online handling this. 11 million? No, that's wrong. 1.1 million? That's clearly wrong. 11,000 Alibaba employees involved. But what's interesting, you can't really see all the details here, but there's an ecosystem for Alibaba. You know, you have people selling online, and these are often small merchants who sell on Taobao. This is where the fakes come in. Not always. And they sell to people. And those people, in the middle is the Alipay service, which is, you know, a huge percentage of payments online from Alibaba. But what's interesting now, the whole logistics infrastructure, the whole online marketing, financing as well, giving credit to customers and to enterprises as well. And then underlying this, where we're going to get much more in the future, is in the operating system, the cloud, and the big data analysis. So ultimately, the value is not just in the transaction, it's about the information. And that's really the next few years' battleground, is this element. Meanwhile, you probably saw that Alibaba, about a year and a half ago, introduced a money market fund, and they were offering 5 to 10 times the rate that you could get in your state bank. Massive interest. This Yuebao service, which means leftover treasure. It's money you have sitting around on your Alipay account. Well, to put it in, you'll get, you know, 8% interest. Sounds good. So pretty soon, like $90 billion had been invested in this fund. It became one of the largest money market funds in the world within the space of a few months. Now, meanwhile, you're plotting banks here. Bank of China, Industrial Commercial Bank of China, you know, these are the state banks, were just blindsided by the fact that all this money suddenly was being sucked away. This is an example where the sky has its limits, because they're able to talk to the government and say, hang on a second, you're destabilizing the Chinese banking service. And so limits were put in place to allow, you know, how much you can actually put onto this service with Alibaba. And a friend of mine was just connecting her bank account the other day to Alipay, and the bank's like, be very, very careful. You know, Alibaba, dodgy, you know. Would you like to try our payment service? So they're finally sort of responding. The Industrial Commercial Bank of China is known as the ICBC. And in Chinese, people joke that that's Ai Tsun Gu Sun. It's like, you want to save, you don't want to save, who cares? Forget about it, right? There's an element in China in the banks, traditionally, it's been a horrible experience. If you thought buying something was bad, try even going to the bank to get the money to pay for it. It is changing in some cases now. China Merchants Bank, some of these banks are beginning to respond. But generally, they've been very plodding. And you know, so this is kind of the limits. Alibaba's getting into movies. Chow Yun-fat is going to be starring in the first Alibaba Pictures production. It's called Baidu Ren. It's not the Baidu of Baidu. It's another Baidu. But where are these companies going? I mean, some people have asked, what is the logic? I mean, Jack, famously drunk, bought a half share in a football team in Guangzhou and said, ha ha, so we'll have to see, you know, is there discipline there? Or is it just grab it while you can, you know, because the private sector has never had it so good. The sky is not the limit for Xiaomi. Now, those of you know Xiaomi is sort of the people's phone, smartphone. They now, the air is very polluted in China, and now this originally smartphone company is now making air purifiers. And it's $150, and it can clear this room in 3 seconds or something. So basically, there is no limit to the ambitions of some of these companies. This company, Xiaomi, allegedly is valued at $41 billion. I don't know. We'll see. But they hired Hugo Barra, who ran Google's Android business, to help their international strategy. So this is, you know, Xiaomi is trying to get into that BAT magic circle. But the fact is, they're moving to consumer products as well as smartphones, home TVs. Now, this is an EasyJet thing, and I've, you know, very stupidly put an Alibaba logo on, but why not, right? I mean, there are actually, you can buy your airline tickets on Alibaba. Why not have an airline? I mean, there are private airlines in China. They were introduced, I think, around 2007. But they've had very limited routes, because guess what? You know, Air China, China Eastern, say, no, you're not going to fly Beijing to Shanghai. We'll give you the 4 o'clock route to, you know, Karachi or somewhere. But they've started to fly international routes But generally, they've kept the cream for themselves. Why not, though, have private sector companies getting into these areas? But then, you know, the big question is, like, how far can these companies go? How can they cultivate the government relationships? But with what they know about customers and how they can connect with them instantly on mobile, they have tremendous power. But again, these are the limits. It's a very grumpy-looking Jack Ma. I don't think it was that day. But the State Administration for Industry and Commerce, you know, there was this weird memo that was leaked 2 weeks ago saying, we find all these fakes on Alibaba. And we told them about this before the IPO, but we didn't release the information because of the IPO, which wasn't very helpful to Alibaba. Alibaba is now being sued, but it's one of these silly class action suits. I don't think it has much merit. But the fact was, there was an interesting standoff because I think for U.S. investors, some have really bought into this idea that Alibaba has the perfect government relations. And actually, China's complicated. There are often different departments, different policies going on. Even for these internet entrepreneurs, it's very difficult to navigate all this stuff. So it was an interesting time when it kind of came out into the open. Alibaba's shares actually dropped, not just because of this. They had some weaker than expected results, or still strong, and they dropped about 10, 15%. And all the employees, you know, waiting, because a lot of the employees are locked up. They can't sell until March or April. So there, you know, there's this constant challenge for these internet companies when they go public. People have become obsessed with the stock price. And so this is quite painful for people. Oh, my God. Do not buy anything until you cash in your options or shares. It's a very important lesson. Anyway, so this interesting standoff. Interestingly, he's married to a woman whose dad was the architect of some of these very early reforms under Deng Xiaoping of opening up consumers. So you're seeing this sort of offline meets online, government meets private. It's all getting very, very mixed up. So discuss. But I like to think of the private sector in China. I know we have to segue to beer and wine. None of you will remember the Heineken ads, but famously they said Heineken refreshes the parts that other beers cannot reach. What I like about this, the private sector in China is really adding color to the lives of people and choice. You know, in China it was gray or blue mouses, right? And I remember some of the first color I saw when I moved there was peasants wearing, like, coming to the town wearing pink, hot pink suits and celebrating their freedom. And I think, you know, the private sector is really, you know, finding those places where they can, you know, add value and win customers. And increasing the state, is it on the back foot or is it going to fight back? This is the big question. But I think it is like Heineken. It's very refreshing for the Chinese consumers, particularly when they give you the beer free, of course. So that's me. I'm also on WeChat, of course, but we can talk about that. So questions?
A lot, Duncan. Bit of a tour de force, I think. I've heard a lot of talks one way or another about China, but I've never quite had such a clear exposition of what's going on in China in this really fast-moving sector.
And that's water, it's not.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the mint.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, one of the big pluses of one of the big pluses about LSE is these sorts of events is we can now get questions from the floor and we can go into greater depth on things that interest us, and we'll do that for a bit before going into a sort of drinks networking thing. What I'd like to know is who would like to ask a question. If you raise your hands, I'm going to point at you one by one, starting with this lady in the middle here. Could you please say who you are before you ask your question? And could you also ask people, questions is great, but very long statements perhaps not. So
160
stay,
characters.
Right.
Daisy Zhou, an LSE student from China originally, also a student of Professor Sao's foreign direct investment class. So thank you for the speech, first of all. Fantastic and brilliant. Even for me to learn a little bit, because I've been overseas for a while, so it's a good catch-up for me. Yeah, change fast indeed. So my question is actually about the competition of those exciting e-commerce companies from China. So when you introduce us to the first batch of those like portal companies, those founders, it's interestingly, they all have a background of overseas study, like Robin Lee of Baidu, he graduated from Google and Xtraction, so on. But for the most recent wave, say Jack Ma or even another Ma from Tencent.
Pony
they all
Ma,
have
yeah.
yeah mm-hmm. They all actually kind of self-made from domestic market and trained domestically. Do you see that as a kind of nice coincidence, or is some indication behind it? Such as, in my understanding, some non-traditional or say non-Western stereotype of innovation is going on in China, which is more differentiate. And do you see that it probably will influence the global internet platform or scenery in the near future? And also, do you think, like, say, for the example you give us, Xiaomi, is it possible that it will become a competitive producer, like to competing head-to-head with Apple someday?
Right.
Yeah, so...
Okay. Yeah, so interesting questions. I mean, in China, there are the sea turtles, right, the famous Chinese students in this room who swim back to China, turtle-like. I think they fly, but anyway. And actually, in the first batch, NetEase, William Ding, had not studied overseas. So, and I worked with him the first year, and he had moved around China. He was from Zhejiang, actually, from Ningbo. But he'd studied in Guangdong, Chengdu, I think, and then Guangdong. But anyway, and also Sina was founded initially by Wang Zhedong in China, who had never left China and doesn't speak much English. So you did have this interesting mix. The case of Sohu, Charles Zhang, who founded Sohu, and Heather and others met him early on. He studied MIT. He had backing from his professor. So it was a good move sometimes. Nicholas Negroponte. Who had backed Sohu. So there was a mix early on, and there still is a mix. I mean, I think the C2C model, the copy-to-China model that everybody talks about, I mean, Robin Lee, you're right, had studied in the States, he'd worked in the States, come back. There's obviously an advantage if you've lived in the States, certainly those early years, you could actually see the internet unfolding. And don't forget, this was sort of happening at the same time. I mean, Yahoo was founded, I think, in 1995, so 20 years ago. So it wasn't, it was starting in the States, but we didn't know how big it would be there. Today, the challenge is that, you can actually be in China and you could see what's happening in the States just through a blog and then do it, So I'm not sure in terms of the benefits. What's interesting about Jack Ma is that he'd failed twice his Gaokao, his higher education entrance. Frankly, he wasn't a very good student in maths. So for those of you here who struggle in math, so I'm not sure what the grade I got on with Professor Estrin. I have to go back and check, but that might have been a problem. But the there is now an openness. I think Jack's education was very much self-education. He was approaching tourists on the streets in Hangzhou, and one of them eventually invited him to Australia, and he spent a month there, and they helped him buy a house. And so there's a lot of interesting elements about Jack not coming through the traditional education system. And I think that's important because the Chinese education system, as you know, is lots of people like me waving my finger around, and you're all supposed to listen and take notes, rote learning, and it tends to crush the human spirit, rather like me. No, hopefully. There is this big debate today amongst Chinese, including my company. A lot of the employees have young children. They don't want their kids to go through that. And so for innovation, this is the big quest. That China had this, known for these amazing inventions, paper, gunpowder, etc., and everything stopped, according to Joseph Needham, in the 16th century, and then China went through this sort of long period of lack of technological innovation. And why is this? And so it's not just a question about communism. It's basically, is it the rote learning? Is it the central sort of driven stuff? There's a lot happening in innovation today, and I think, people, Jack Ma has commented on this about innovation too. You're looking at tweaking. You're looking at micro-innovations, adapting, putting two different things together in a new way. It's not radical eureka inventions a la, the light bulb, leap out, eureka sort of stuff. So I think there's a lot of this consumer-led innovation that's happening in China, and these Chinese entrepreneurs often are better at applying that than, say, the Western companies. Even Google, for example, one of the challenges people said was that the search bar was too short for Chinese search, and Baidu had a longer one. If you open a Baidu or in most Chinese internet pages, probably you should put on a pair of sunglasses because there's so much going on, And the sort of minimalist Google white thing, So there's a home court advantage that local entrepreneurs, perhaps who haven't left, sometimes are better at understanding. But what's interesting now, the big difference is that, capital is available domestically. We didn't really talk about this, but there's huge amounts of venture capital, crowdfunding as well. As well as quite large, very large private equity investment in China itself. Whereas in the early days, like Robin Lee or, say, Xiao Yibo, who founded EachNet, which ended up, being bought by eBay, he went to Harvard, he met friends, they invested. Today, you don't need China to raise money. In fact, there's too much money in China, actually.
So I think, to your point, it's an interesting evolution. I like the fact that there is a choice. I mean, there are homegrown entrepreneurs who've never left who do very well. There are those who are educated and come back who do very well. And there are people who fail all around. So it's somewhat democratic in that sense. And with respect to Xiaomi, now Xiaomi is founded by a guy called Lei Jun, who has been at Kingsoft many years. And he famously wears black turtlenecks, prances around on stage saying one more thing. You know, one wonders where he gets his inspiration, you know. you know, it's, Steve Jobs once told me, never drop names. But anyway, I think, yeah, he tends to create this mythology around him. But how big can they go? It's interesting. Hugo Barr, I mentioned, is their vice president who's helping them expand internationally. Xiaomi is trying to export its model of very cheap smartphones, reasonably cheap smartphones, under $100, $150, into markets like India, Indonesia, and so on. It's facing some headways. In some cases, they're getting sued, like in India, by Ericsson for patent issues. And in other places, just lots of cultural challenges. But it's a huge company with huge ambitions and a huge valuation. So don't discount them. But this cultivation of the Apple culture, I mean, I look around the room, Apple is omnipresent here. In fact, there'd even be more in China. So Apple clearly is something that Chinese consumers covet, but not everybody can afford, you know, the prices of these things. And as you know, there are not only fake iPhones in China, there are fake Apple stores selling real products, but actually fake stores. So what Xiaomi is trying to fill is, yeah, clearly there's demand for the functionality of smartphones at a lower price point. But it's so cheap, their price point, in terms of they're not making money on the hardware. You have to question, you know, where's the money coming from? They say it's coming from software and content. We'll see. It's tough. But there's a lot of excitement around Xiaomi. I'm still a bit on the fence. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Hello, my name's Steve Twigg. I'm studying media communications and development. This might be a really simple question, actually, but you were talking about the boom of e-commerce, and I was wondering about the practical infrastructure side to support that, especially considering that although China's population is probably quite concentrated near urban areas, it's a massive country, and with international development as well, being quite far from some of the markets like the US and Europe, how do they keep costs down on that sort of thing and grow in such a booming way?
Well, most of the stuff is made in China. So what was very interesting about 2008 was when suddenly the export markets collapsed, suddenly, you know, people started saying, well, what can we sell in China? So all these manufacturers have been exporting. And I had this chance as an expat. I'd live in China, and I'd travel to the U.S. and go to Target or Walmart or something, and I would see all this great stuff made in China, reasonably great but cheap. I'm half Scottish, I said, stuff. But I couldn't get it in China. You couldn't get the stuff in China. And I think 2008 was really a turning point when suddenly all these factories had all this stuff piling up. And this is when Taobao really took off for Alibaba. But the logistics, I mean, China's been investing massively in road, rail. I don't know if you are Monty Python fans, but, you know, what have the Romans ever done for us? You know, and then the Palestinian goes, the aqueduct, roads, irrigation. I mean, the Chinese are like this in Africa as well. You see the Chinese building infrastructure. You know, the first thing they do is build a road, you know. So in a way, the physical infrastructure had been there and was there massively. Yes, there was some corruption when they built the high-speed train thing, but you know what? You get from Beijing to Shanghai in 4.5 hours at 300 kilometers is fantastic. This is happening also for freight. More of a challenge has been warehousing, and you know, but companies like Jingdong are investing huge amounts in this, and Alibaba itself is investing in some of these logistics companies. So it's there. The postal service, the express mail service in China is very reliable. I think overnight is 10 kuai or 20 kuai, you know, so 2-3 pounds overnight delivery. So the sort of elements were there, but nobody had really pulled it together. And now, as I said, you know, for the postal service, it's their biggest customer is Alibaba. I mean, so. Yeah, so strangely, it was, you know, the stuff was kind of coming together, but nobody had really figured it out. And I think this is why the early mover advantage, I think, of Alibaba has been so great. But they are facing some competitors, and Jingdong is more like an Amazon in the sense that they, you know, they actually own the inventory. You know, Amazon, if you look at it, there's always been questions about how profitable Amazon is. In fact, Jack Ma last year said Alibaba has made more money in 15 days than Amazon in 15 years. And that's actually true, because Alibaba is a platform. They don't actually own the inventory. Now, the government's saying, well, a lot of stuff is fake. And but, I mean, there are benefits to that model, and there's also benefits to having the quality of assurance and so on of Jingdong and other providers. So infrastructure is kind of there. It just nobody had really stitched it together. Yeah.
Lady here with the computer room.
It's an Apple.
Apple, yeah.
Not a Xiaomi. You could have a Xiaomi. It looks very similar.
Hello, my name is Lolo. I'm a master management student. I was born in Shanghai. Huge fan about tech industry, so this has been really a treat for me. Thank you for that. My question is related to, you know, how internet company in the Silicon Valley nowadays, they are called the born global because they don't have any the physical, you know, boundaries, the suppliers that the conventional business has, and most of them are basically online everywhere in the world automatically when they were born. How would you give any consultation towards those companies, such as Airbnb or Prezi, those, you know, relatively smaller ones?
I mean, use Prezi today, but I thought you'd all get motion sickness.
Yeah, actually, I actually work for Prezi right now for marketing.
Great.
Because there are two barriers that we can see right now. One is the things that you can't change, the political environment and the policymaking. That could be challenging, but we don't care about that because we can't change that. The things that we can change is about how you localize your product, right, and operation, etc. But it's so challenging because the culture is so different. Would you tell them to give it a try and go in market, or would you say it's hopeless?
Right. So I would apply something I call the litmus test. You know, a patient comes in. You know, you want to analyze the situation. So if you're in a social media environment where you have the ability through your app to mobilize millions of people in 5 seconds to a flash mob in Tiananmen Square, I'm sorry, I can't help you. So the acidic side of the litmus test is sort of social media, you know, news, you know, mass mobilization. It's really going to be difficult for you. And this is the challenge that Twitter, you know, and Jack Dorsey said, you know, he'd love to be in China, but he's never been, well, they were briefly, and then it got blocked. And he said, it's a trade issue for him. It's like, we can't do anything, you know. So if you're that in that segment of the litmus, you know, strip, I don't really see it. But what's been interesting is companies that aren't in such sensitive areas, quote unquote. So LinkedIn, for example, or Evernote. Now, LinkedIn itself managed to get into the headlines by, they found a partner in China, Great Broadband Capital, which is Tian Suning, Edward Tian, and some other people, and Murdoch and others had invested. Anyway, they found a partner who can invest. And yet they have a Chinese company run by, there's a Chinese individual who, you know, with that VIE thing, you know, so they, and, you know, you think LinkedIn is about job creation, the Chinese government wants to create lots of jobs, and so they're basically trying to say, look, we're not here to threaten, but even in LinkedIn, I mean, you can actually post information, you can share information, so famously people in Hong Kong and elsewhere in the world actually found themselves being blocked, or you would post something about China. We're sorry, due to content restrictions, we cannot post your thing. Like, what? You know, so they got into some hot water. But the reality is they don't really care. I mean, they're saying, we're going to go for the domestic China market. We, you know, what they've also done is interesting is they've incentivized the staff in LinkedIn China that in 3 or 4 years' time, LinkedIn has the right to buy more of that company or actually buy, you know, incentivize those people to make money. Because the challenge is if you're working as an employee for like a Western company, in China versus your friend, your classmate who's working for this Chinese internet company that might go public, you know, you feel, this is why talent has tended to gravitate recently away. That wasn't the case initially. I mean, a lot of people wanted to work for Google, and some very fine people did. But a lot of them have gone on to found other companies. So, yeah, so I think there is, you know, I mentioned Evernote as well, and some of these less mass market, you know, maybe some of the e-commerce players as well. Amazon is still in China. It has 2% of the market. But it has, you know, a few thousand people in China. They're hanging on. Jeff Bezos is very reluctant to give up on China. Meg Whitman, famously, when she was fighting Jack Ma, said, whoever wins China will, you know, win the world, sort of thing. So, well, she lost. So there's a lot of pride here. I mentioned earlier, you know, this, you know, Excalibur. People want to see that they can beat their way. But the best way is to find a kind of a niche area, find a partner. But it's not easy. It isn't easy. But there are profitable niches that people will hang on to. And the other thing you can do in China is development. I mean, there's amazing talent in China. I mean, Silicon Valley, we know, is actually built by Chinese and Indians anyway, right? So building in China itself makes a lot of sense. And even Google today still has R&D, and it's not very big. Microsoft has a big R&D center. So companies can, and that's what they've been doing with like Evernote and elsewhere. They have R&D centers in China as well as operating in that market. But there's no, you know, pass, I think, for people like Facebook, Twitter. I just don't see how they do it. And don't forget, I mean, companies like Yahoo, Microsoft, and Google were called up in front of the U.S. Congress 10 years ago to explain themselves in China for censorship, and in the case of Shi Tao, who's an individual arrested for using Yahoo Mail. So there is, you know, on the one hand, you know, if Zuckerberg wants to suddenly say, we'll block everything for everybody in China, and, you know, I don't really know how that would play at home. So, but they love the challenge, you know. They just can't take no for an answer. And Zuckerberg's a young guy still, right? So, and of course, he now famously speaks Chinese, so why would he want all that to go to waste, even though his wife is a Cantonese speaker? Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. I'm Moritz. I'm a master's student at LSE. And while I was an undergraduate student, I spent some time in China. So I also have a basic knowledge of Chinese, but I'm far away from fluent. I'm very interested in entrepreneurship in China. But my question is, how important was it for your entrepreneurial journey with BDA to be fluent in Chinese? And also, how difficult do you think is it for Westerners to set up a company in China compared to well-educated Chinese people?
Okay. Well, firstly, I wasn't fluent at all. I didn't know anything when I arrived there, which was great, because when I moved to China in 1994, there were still lots of red banners. I thought there were Coca-Cola advertisements, but they were probably political slogans. So I still actually don't read many Chinese characters. That's been very helpful. But ignorance is not always a defense anymore in China, I would say. You know, in the last few years, I was running the British Chamber of Commerce, and one of the members of the British Chamber of Commerce and his wife were arrested for, you know, GSK. They were investigating some stuff, and, you know, we used to say when we arrived in China in 94, you know, what's the worst they can do to you? Kick you out of the country. No longer the case. and might say, you know, some people might say that's a normal situation. I mean, we don't, you know, would Chinese expect to go to the US and say, sorry, diplomatic immunity, you know, so. But there was this sort of crazy days of the 90s, frankly, where you could get away with some of this stuff. My friend Fritz Demopoulos was the founder of Chunar, which is the travel app like Kayak that ended up getting bought by Baidu. And his Chinese is appalling. In fact, he loves torturing people with his bad Chinese. But he came up with this great name of Chunar, which is mean where are you going in a heavy Beijing accent. So sometimes being an outsider helps. I think the days of you arriving and sort of raising capital and getting something going for the Chinese market as a foreigner are pretty much over. But there are some interesting exceptions for the international market. I was luckily involved in a company that was a games company. We needed to do some measurement of how our game was doing versus others. And we had this tool, and it became this company called App Annie. And, you know, my Norwegian friend founded the company in Beijing. We hired a Frenchman as a CEO. They've just closed their D round investment from, you know, they did Sequoia and all stuff. So this is it was foreigners in China who were tapping into the Chinese talent pool. But more importantly, I think the entrepreneurial kind of feeling that there is in Beijing, you know, the nice thing about being in China is you don't accept anything. Like, everything is questioned. You know, if, for example, you can't get on Facebook, well, great. Maybe you're going to do something productive with your time for a change, you know. So somehow being in China is a good place to kind of think differently about the world. And some Westerners have started to do that. I would counter now, though, that with all these problems with internet access, you know, if you want to develop an app, which is APIs, you know, links into Facebook and Twitter, you know, it's getting increasingly difficult. I mean, you can still do it, but there's a fear now in the tech community in Beijing and Shanghai and elsewhere that they will lose access to the web. And I think that's hopefully going to limit the government's, you know, sort of hunting down these VPNs, because it's hurting Chinese developers. I mean, interestingly, you know, a lot of Chinese companies are trying to advertise on Facebook. So, you know, governments are advertising, visit our Facebook page, not in China. So, it's a really weird situation. But China knows it needs Twitter and Facebook internationally, but won't have it. So I'm not sure how tenable this is. But anyway, I would go to China to learn about the place, meet people. There's capital there. You maybe raise money in China and spend it somewhere else, because there's so much bloody money in China right now. There's more money than projects, actually. And it is all about China. I mean, you can go to Southeast Asia. I was just in Singapore talking. You know, it just, I mean, Indonesia is a fascinating market. That's one that's growing. But the scale of China is on such a different level that investors tend to get pulled there. And, of course, India. And India now is a place that is attracting a lot of interest, including from Chinese companies as well. But in the middle, you know, the best thing, I would raise the money in China and then move to Thailand. And I know a bunch of entrepreneurs are doing that now, because the internet became so slow in Beijing. They said, let's just go down to Koh Samui and we'll just code. So not a bad idea for the Beijing winter. But pretend you're a Chinese company, yeah.
This lady here is next.
Hello, Ye De Wang, a freelance of a Chinese newspaper, and this is not for interview.
Oh.
All right, yeah.
I self-censored anyway, so I'm used to it.
Yeah, four questions.
What did I say? Sorry.
Yeah, four questions. First, that in the terms of the merger between Didi Dutch,
the two taxi
softwares, Didi Dutch and Kuaidi Dutch, some people say that this merger will cause a monopoly in China. In the taxi market, but recently the representative of one of the companies says their market share is only 15%. How could that be happen? Because as far as we know, that we only know Didi and Kuaidi. We don't know other.
No, there are other companies like Yidao, Yongchi. Like, I don't really know them, but they actually famously you can use your phone to have a Tesla pick you up in Beijing now.
Oh,
so why not, right? So. There are a lot of actually, you know, the great thing about China is, and the terrible thing about China is that any good idea attracts like a gazillion people very quickly. So it's like the lemming situation, you know, that suddenly everybody's piling into this. We've seen this over the years, you know, it used to be making television suddenly became unattractive. You can make 2% margin, and for people who are losing minus 50, you know, yes. So then they drive the margin to this is what's called the China price, right? It has a global impact where they suck the margin out of businesses. This is what took down some of the companies like Nortel, for example, Huawei. And, you know. So we've seen this crowd, not crowdfunding, but like crowd mania, where chasing these ideas. And we're seeing that in some of these areas as well. So a lot of these ventures in ride sharing or ride booking apps have, you know, attracted a lot of capital. There's quite a lot of differentiation, though. Some, for example, are taxi fleets or car fleets that have added this to the service. They have access to cars. Others are working with private individuals. You know, so there's a range of services. Uber was quite late to the party, actually. It has a very small market share. It tends to be the more kind of what we call gold-collar, above white-collar people in China who know Uber, you know, who've used it overseas. So there are actually quite a few companies here. So not all of them will make money, though. And so and regulation's an issue, too. Certain jurisdictions have banned some of these ride-sharing things, you know, not quite as much as Paris, but you know, there's always going to be government reaction. And there's a big debate today about all this job creation that's happening in China, clearly, as I described the couriers, all these people selling on Taobao, or these your drivers. But at the same time, there's job destruction. And, you know, there's a concern at the senior levels from the Xi Jinping sort of level about, well, the beneficiaries are younger people, perhaps more nimble, but there could be major job dislocation. Interestingly, for taxis, though, they were so unhappy anyway. I mean, you couldn't get a taxi for love nor money in Beijing or Shanghai because the rates are so low. It was just, you know, they didn't want to be seen to be increasing the price of, you know, cost of living. And so nobody could get a taxi. And you've seen, like, you know, a pregnant woman, you know, with, you know, carrying luggage or something being pushed out of the way by some executive to get into a taxi. I mean, it's ruthless, you know. So now, actually, I think they provided a great service, actually, these taxi booking apps. I used one on my way here, and it works very well. So yes, I don't think we're at a consolidation. It's interesting. There's so many people who go for these models, and there's so much capital available. But not all these people can win. You know?
And the next question is about the
actually,
the two-parter.
There's such a lot of people. I'm sorry. Maybe there's...
Take it to WeChat. I'll send you my WeChat.
You can talk. at the back? Right at the back?
You'll find me on WeChat. I'll do look around, and then you can add me.
Hello. Paul Henderson, recently graduated from the University of Hong Kong.
Oh, right.
I was interested in coming, actually, because I wanted to hear what you thought about the advisory services that foreigners come to you for now that the tech industry is booming, but also at the same time that I suppose foreigners are becoming more confident with investing in China. How has it affected the type of services that they seek out from you?
More confident?
I think that they're becoming more confident.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think it's bifurcating. I mean, there are a lot of multinationals in China who are very unhappy, particularly U.S., technology companies who are now big names. Some people like IBM, Qualcomm was just fined almost $1 billion by the Chinese government for allegedly manipulating the market. IBM and others are losing contracts because, frankly, Edward Snowden has had a huge impact in unveiling stuff that the U.S. was doing, probably shouldn't have been doing or shouldn't have been caught doing. And this is emboldening a lot of local companies and the Chinese government to exclude contracts. For example, the banking system in China relies heavily still on IBM servers, and suddenly you know, there are Chinese companies coming and saying, look, these people aren't safe. We can guarantee safety. Interestingly, the banks and others are very nervous about trying some of these local solutions, but the government is effectively instructing them, so you have to buy, you know, or at least try these local providers. So it's a weird time. If you look at the survey of investor opinion of multinationals in China, it's becoming quite negative. Number one thing is they're concerned about the pollution. In Beijing, you can't transfer staff, certainly with children, to Beijing today. International schools in Beijing, classes are closing. They can't get students. They can't get the teachers. So there are some of the kind of just basic issues of being a multinational are becoming a challenge. What I would argue, though, is that investors are becoming even more excited about China. So what I describe with this VIE and others is a way for you as an international investor, you know, you could be a private equity investor or you could be buying the shares in the stock market, of backing Chinese managed companies. And some of these have done extremely well. So it's very interesting. I mean, on the one hand, you might have big Western companies like in Silicon Valley, the challenges we've talked about, you know, Cisco or Facebook, Google, really frustrated by China. But just next door on Sand Hill Road, where the investors are backing Baidu and Alibaba, they've never made more money than in their lives. So the U.S. is kind of, it's a different experience. Increasingly, there's an old saying in China, be a merchant, don't be a missionary. You know, the missionaries tried to convert China. Well, they ended up with their heads chopped off. You know, the merchants built Hong Kong, where you were starting. I mean, there was this idea, and they were selling dodgy stuff to start with, but, you know, this idea of trading with China. And as an investor, you're thinking about backing Chinese entrepreneurs increasingly. But that's a big change, because the big risk is if China cuts off the multinationals too much, it's going to create a lot of trade friction in the United States. Because don't forget, these Chinese companies are expanding in the U.S. Alibaba has an office now in Seattle, as well as, you know, two offices in Silicon Valley. So there's a lot of interesting stuff happening now on the trade policy side. But there are some people who are very confident in investing, but not so much the multinationals, who have a lot of things at stake. Yeah. U.S. tech is the worst place right now because of Snowden, frankly. If you're a Unilever or a P&G, you know, China's still a very, very important market. Yum Brands or KFC. I mean, but even though those companies have faced challenges, you know, being seen to be selling dodgy stuff or, you know, exploiting the market. So the nationalism is kind of creeping up in China. But the great news in China, and look at Apple. I mean, Apple is the most successful tech company. Everybody wants to buy Apple. So it's pretty hard to stop Chinese from buying Apple. If you try, anyway, they go to New York, they come here. I mean, if you go to any Apple store in the world, you have to join a queue behind Chinese people. So the Chinese are not very patriotic when it comes to buying things. You know, they tried the milk. It didn't work out too well for them. So.
I'm only going to take one more question, but there'll be lots of opportunity after that. So where am I going to take? Well, this lady here.
My name is Judy, and I am from MSc student here from Silicon Valley, and I actually used to translate press releases for Tencent.
Okay. Well done. Something
Tony
worked.
Ma. Mike, well, you were talking about the difficulty of U.S. tech companies to go into China and the amount of difficulty they face. It struck me a little weird because there's the WTO and there's free trade agreements, and excuse my ignorance, but I feel like there's got to be some ground for the U.S. to use some technicalities to enter the Chinese market. And
WTO was a bit like the Munich Agreement, you know, when Chamberlain said peace in our time, you know, we've solved the Hitler problem, you know. Charlene Barshefsky, who was the U.S. trade negotiator, famously, you know, said we've solved, you know, telecom access, so foreign telcos can buy into China. So in theory today, AT&T or BT, for example, has the right to buy up to whatever it is today, 49% of a Chinese company. The problem is there's only like two or three Chinese companies. They're all controlled by the Chinese government. And they say, sorry, we're not interested. So WTO was sort of an attempt to construct market access. But even in lower value areas now, like telecom, it never really worked. Now we're into things like content. Cultural stuff was never included in the WTO, right? Then if they can classify anything as content or, you know, news media, then that's just off limits. So WTO was a big disappointment in many ways for multinational companies that wanted to become deeper invested in China. It didn't really happen. It had a lot of beneficial effects in the outside of tech, in trade and in other areas, and actually it had a huge benefit to the Chinese economy because it helped the Chinese government drive reform in state-owned enterprises. For example, in the banking sector, WTO was used as a stick to beat the Chinese banks to improve in certain areas by threatening them with Citibank and HSBC. But those companies today, foreign banks in China, have 0.01% of the market. I mean, they never were able to really build up what they wanted to. So WTO was a useful tool by the government to drive reform, but it never really delivered the open market because China feels it doesn't need to do that. And they, you know, they've successfully shown that they can build up their own companies and telecoms and other areas. But tech, WTO was entry was a long time ago, and tech moves much quicker. And so I think it's not that relevant, frankly. It should be. I agree with you, but it isn't. So.
Well, look, Duncan, it's been a really excellent discussion. Very good questions from everyone and very good answers. You made the point earlier that Chinese rote learning type education crushes the human spirit, but I hope that LSE type question and answer open yes. discussion does exact opposite and raises the spirit. And just in case it doesn't, we're going to now raise a glass or two.
Very good.
At the back.
Should be Qingdao, not Heineken.
And I'd like to thank you on behalf of everybody.
Thank you, Professor.